Hello and welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. My name is Wolfgang Vachon. According to the Anne E. Casey Foundation, there are about 5.5 million people in the U.S. who work directly with children or youth. Many of these people consider themselves youth workers. Some think of themselves as CYC practitioners, others use different labels to define what they do. All are connected in their commitment to helping young people. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Dana Fusco, Associate Professor in Teaching Education at York College, City University of New York. Earlier this year, Dana published Advancing Youth Work, Current Trends, Critical Questions, a book she edited with contributions from around the world. I've asked Dana to speak with us today about the trends and questions youth work faces. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to begin by asking you, what was your motivation to create this book?
That's a good question. My motivation came because I began to see these emerging trends in the field. And I thought that the various trends that were happening both in the United States and around the world weren't so much in dialogue with one another, but that all perhaps were defining the field, and if there were a possibility to create a anthology, if you will, or a collection of those voices, that we might more intentionally impact where we were going together.
And what were some of those specific trends that were beginning to emerge as you were reading literature?
So there were three trends, and you know, these trends are workforce trends. So for many years, while I worked with young people and studied youth programs, this kind of moved me into a new and different direction, which was looking at the staff of programs and youth workers and what was happening at that level of the workforce in terms of preparing the workforce. So the trends are in relationship to the workforce. The three trends are the competency movement that was happening largely in North America, specifically the United States and Canada. And in the United States, I think at one point I had counted 120 some odd competency frameworks.
Wow.
That had emerged over maybe an 8-year period or so to kind of define out what youth workers should know and be able to do. And that was rather stunning to, you know, be coming across that over and over and over again and beginning to question what was happening here. Why was this the direction we were going in? How could it be, or how is it helpful for the field? The second trend was related, all of these are related, it was the movement towards credentialing of youth workers. So the idea being that the competency framework then defines what youth workers should know and be able to do, and then once they demonstrate or evidence that knowledge and skill base, they then become credentialed as youth workers. So there's that trend. The final trend was the trend within higher education, which I call the third C, or curriculum. And that was the emergence, particularly in the U.S. abroad, they had a more longer history in higher ed with programs for youth work and youth studies. In the U.S., it was a more recent phenomena. And in fact, it was a 900% growth in programs specifically designed, degree programs specifically designed for youth workers. So those were the three trends: competencies, credentials, and curriculum.
Can we go through those three points one by one?
Sure.
Let's start with the competency movement. So my first question would be, you identified 120 different competency frameworks. Were there overlap in these competencies?
Yes. And there were a couple of studies that did kind of a meta-analysis of the competencies to show where the overlap was. And some of that work is published. And I think that where what we didn't do a great a job at was looking at where the gaps were, so we could kind of identify the overlaps. But if you say, here's a list of 10 things, then who decides what those 10 things are, and then what are the other things that never made it to the list? So if you compare list A and list B, it doesn't necessarily help. It helps you identify what is there and what the overlaps are. It doesn't so much help you identify what did we miss to begin with. So that, to me, was and is something that I think still needs to be addressed for the field in terms of how, not so much, you know, should we have competency frameworks? I mean, to be honest, my initial response to them, and this even comes from having sat in on and participated in a group here in New York City where we actually developed one of these competency frameworks, and I participated in that process. My experience as a participant in it was that I felt very alienated from the content. And I think there's a way that what you're pulling from when you're developing competency frameworks is a very kind of theoretically removed from context, removed from practice type of narrative. And that narrative may or may not best map onto the actual practice of youth work.
And why do you think there is that removal or alienation from practice?
I'm not sure. I mean, some of that, I would say, is just human nature in how we construct and use language, particularly when the language that we're trying to construct, in this case, in the frame of competencies, where we're trying to be theoretical, we're trying to be comprehensive, we tend to pull from a certain lexicon, right? A school's lexicon, if you will. And I think that some folks, you know, have done a better job at including different voices at the table. But I think the very process of doing it, there's something about the process of doing it, I think, that we end up missing. We end up missing some stuff. That said, I've been won over a little bit from practitioners who some have felt it was helpful for them. So then the question is not so much whether we have it or don't have it, but then how it's used.
Right.
If it's used as kind of a self-reflection tool for practitioners so that they can look at this framework and say, you know, how do I see myself in this framework? Does it fit with how I define myself as a youth worker? Does it help me to advance my practice in any way? When I look at this list, do I say, oh, you know what, I'm really good at this one. I'm not so good at that one. Maybe this is something I can work on. If it's used in that kind of self-reflective way, I think it can be beneficial. But when we start using it to regulate, to monitor, to credential, that's where I get a little more worried. Because we don't know that it's a valid set of things to begin with. We haven't validated it in any way. So we take a process that, in essence, is, you know, a group of smart people, well-intentioned people, sitting in a room, coming up with this, vetting it over some period of time, but we don't really have any way of validating it against actual practice. We've not done that work. How would we do that?
Yeah. How do we validate it?
Well, I guess, you know, methodologically, there are some ways of doing that, you know, such as, the, you know, turning some of those into maybe observational tools, interview tools, and collecting, you know, it would have to be a research project. It would have to be some way of collecting data on those things to say, yeah, this actually does define good practice pretty well. But maybe it misses some things. And then how do you do it in a way that captures the context? You know, this is the other thing, because the competency frameworks by design are very broad. They're broad statements, they're broad concepts. So when we say things like supporting the development of young people, I mean, that can mean a quadrillion things in the world of youth work practice, right? So what it ends up looking like on the ground, there are multiple interpretations of that. And that's fine. I'm open to those interpretations. I think I think it's good to have those interpretations, but then how do you assess it? So again, if we're simply using it as a way for to give people a map, right, some schema to think about their work, then I think it has value.
And are you seeing people use it in that way, that it's being presented, distributed to youth workers in the field to say, hey, here's a reflection tool for you to use?
You know, I'm not as up on how people are using the competency framework. The sense of it that I have is that in some places they were developed and they're kind of sitting dormant. In other places, my sense is that people are using it to promote some dialogue. In fact, in one of the chapters in my book, Sarah Jonas talks about how the Children's Aid Society used the competency framework that they developed and how they used it to kind of guide their staff training, their hiring practices, their staff evaluation practices. So that's a good local example of how at least one very large multi-site youth agency developed their own and used it in a kind of emergent and organic way.
Have you spoken with any youth workers in that organization about the impact of the competencies on their work?
I have not personally, but I do believe that Sarah in the chapter does bring in some quotes from some of the folks that she works with.
Yeah, she certainly does. Yeah. One of the things that you said is it's unclear what we're missing. Perhaps this is an impossible question to answer if we're unclear on what we're missing. Do you have a sense of what may be missing? So here's an observation that I have. I'm not aware of how much youth involvement there is in developing these competencies, for example. Is that a way that the competencies are missing elements?
Yeah, so I think some of it is, you know, who's missing and then what's missing, right? So in terms of who's missing, clearly the voice of youth is not represented in anything that I've seen. And I think frontline youth workers, I think that voice is also missing. There's been some attempt at inclusion of frontline youth workers, but more of the people who have been involved are they're the full-time staffers, so they're the coordinators and directors of programs. And that's fine. I mean, I think, you know, they are good people to have at the table, obviously. So, yeah, so I think, you know, in terms of who's missing, then if you think across the broad, diverse set of practices that youth work encompasses, then I think who's missing are youth workers who are working with street youth, gang youth, other indigenous populations. So I think some of what we would call at this point more of the marginalized youth and youth workers and youth practices are largely the ones that seem to me to be missing. So and also the ones that come from that place of more of a critical practice, a critical pedagogy. But the rhetoric then that frames the existing competency frameworks can only be represented in a certain way. I mean, the lack of that voice there, I think, has a bigger impact in the field than we are acknowledging, because it delegitimizes those practices. If we're saying these are the competency frameworks that will lead to the credentialing of youth work, and there's been an absence of voice, then the absence of voice further delegitimizes that voice and therefore that set of practice. And that's what concerns me about the whole thing.
And do you have a sense of why those voices are not present?
Yeah, I don't think it's anything intentional. I think, you know, we're mostly well-intentioned folks who do what we do as human beings. We say, hey, let's come together at the table. Who should we invite? And you invite the people that you know and work with over the years. And, you know, I think it's a very innocent kind of exclusion. The point is, though, that we therefore have to work explicitly to make sure we're being inclusive. And that is a, you know, that's a skill set that we want in our youth workers, isn't it? So if we're not modeling it as a field, then that's also problematic.
Yes, certainly. So we have these competencies, which you've laid out quite clearly what some of the risks are of the competencies, what's present, what's not present, how they could be used effectively. And you also flag some of your concerns about their use, and specifically about the credentialization of youth work. Could you talk a little bit more about what's happening in this area?
In the credentialing area?
Yes, please.
This is mostly happening in the CYC, child and youth care, field than it is in other sectors of youth work. So largely, there's a North American, and I may botch the name at the moment, the North American Certification Project. So it's mostly the CYC practitioners that can sit for a credentialing exam. I haven't followed it in the past year or two, so I'm less knowledgeable at the moment in terms of what their current status is. I know that they piloted the exam. I know that they had one cohort go through the exam, and I'm not sure if they're now in a second cohort. I'm also not sure if there's been any research done on the relationship between, you know, those who are credentialed or not credentialed. There is a, seems to be a movement to link that up to the National After School Association. So the folks who are largely engaged in the credentialing exam for CYC, at least in the United States, are collaborating with the National After School Association around kind of marrying the competency frameworks and therefore potentially marrying the credentialing process. So again, I'm not too privy at the moment as to where they are in that process. You know, there could be some other people that I could give you some names of folks that if you were interested in doing a follow-up with them, you know, they would be better people to talk to about the current status of that. My sense of it is that they've had a hard time selling it, that in some ways it seems that the move to professionalize the field is attractive for different reasons, legitimate reasons. You know, will it give the field greater recognition? Will it give the field greater legitimacy in the world? Will that therefore improve kind of work conditions and wages and benefits for, you know, for youth workers? Those are good things to work on. Whether or not credentialing is the way to get there, to me, remains an unanswered question. So it's a pretty high-stakes system to embed into the workforce, given that we're not exactly sure what the ramifications of it would be.
So you addressed some of the reasons around employment, around pay, around validation. Are those the main justifications or benefits seen to this credentialization process?
There seem to be three. One is the one we already discussed, which is that it will improve wages and work conditions for youth workers. So those are labor issues. The second is that it will improve quality of programs, that if what you have is a quote-unquote professional workforce, then you could somewhat better guarantee the quality of programs for young people. And the third is that it legitimizes the field by creating better public will, public recognition for the work. So right now, if you ask the general public, what is youth work? Most people will say, I don't know. You know, does it mean that, you know, young people are working, for instance?
Right.
So there, we don't have a good kind of public sense of the work, right? So unlike law or medicine or other professions where people know what a doctor is, they know what a teacher is, they know what a social worker is. The idea is if you professionalize the field, people would know what a youth worker is, what a youth worker does. So those are the three main reasons.
And is there evidence that those three rationales play out in reality?
I can find none. and I've looked, it's rather interesting, and I've looked at whether, you know, what if there's any research on whether that any of those things hold up for other professions. And it's not as linear, you know, as that. It's a much more complex phenomenon. So it kind of raises this question, and, you know, we're producing this special edition that should be coming out maybe in the spring, that'll address this issue and what, you know, what is the evidence and how are we thinking about professionalization and what are the roots to that? Because I think the one thing that we can agree on is that what we're looking to do is to improve opportunities for young people, mm-hmm. right? And I think if we start there and then say, what helps us do that? Then that can lead to a whole new set of questions and strategies and discussions and dialogues that I think we're not having right now. So, for instance, for me, when I think about what would help improve or better opportunities for young people, and I think about that in my own context, being in New York City right now, I feel like the very first thing I would want to tackle is that we've had so many cuts to programs. So forget about, you know, are the staff qualified or not qualified? We don't have enough staff that are even employed in this area anymore because so many programs have been cut.
Right.
So what's happening now, and I see it even in my own neighborhood, kids are hanging out on the street more. They're getting arrested more. Youth crime is back up. And we know that once they start going into that system, it's very hard for them to get out of that system.
The last two podcasts I did, one with Graham Tiffany, who works out of the UK, and then Von Bowie, who works out of Australia, we're speaking to very similar issues. And both of them work a lot with tree-identified youth, very itinerant populations, and speak to those exact same pressures around cuts. And Von Bowie talks about the workplace violence and how the cuts are increasing workplace violence in organizations that work with children and youth because there's not the staffing there to adequately support the young people and improve the opportunities for young people. It would,
wow. Yeah, the domino effect.
Yeah. I'm finding this last piece quite curious around the cuts because the third trend that you identified was a 900% increase in growth in degree programs in the U.S., and what mm-hmm. I'm hearing you say is that there's not employment for people once they graduate.
That's correct. Higher ed is, you know, usually, you know, 10 to 30 years behind the rest of the world. So, you know, that's what happens, right? So by the time you get programs up and running, you know, the world has changed. And, you know, it's part of the reason why it's not such a great idea to go to develop curriculum based on market trends, because those market trends, by the time you get curriculum up and running, have already changed. There are jobs. There are lots of jobs. Unfortunately, those jobs are largely part-time jobs. And so people piecemeal things. Mm-hmm. There's not as many full-time jobs. Now, most of the full-time jobs, there has been a credentialing creep. Most of those full-time jobs now, and again, I'm speaking from local context, most of those full-time jobs now require a college degree, some a master's degree. So the part-timers, you know, can get jobs with some college credit, but not necessarily needing a degree. It used to be the case that if you had any experience with young people or even just an interest working with young people, you could get a job. And if they deemed you effective with kids, or trainable at least, then they'd keep you around, and if not, they'd let you go. And those things were handled locally. They were handled within organizations, and my experience of it is that they handled that just fine without the need for any kind of credential or assessment or whatever. But in the world at large, right, there's been this kind of credential creep. It's very difficult to find any livable wage job these days without at least an undergraduate degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly the case here in Canada. Yeah. I'm intrigued with the growth in degree programs. I know, for example, in Australia, there's been a decrease in post-secondary mm-hmm. education opportunities for youth workers, that they've been shutting programs down. Are there any exemplary, my experience is in Canada, and we have diploma programs and, in 2 and 3 year college programs, we have undergraduate programs, we have master's programs, we have PhD programs, all focused in youth studies or child and youth care, CYC programs. So I think of Canada as a country with a fairly comprehensive post-secondary education framework. Are there other countries, locations around the world that have decent post-secondary education opportunities for people who want to enter this field?
Well, I think that the UK does, and they did more strongly. There's also been cuts there, and some of their youth studies courses, like the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, for instance, had a very strong program for 30 years or maybe even longer. And that program was cut last year. Mm. So, there were a couple in Australia, and there's been a couple throughout the UK that have been recently cut. Now, the question is, are they being cut because the jobs aren't there? That's one possibility. I'm not sure that that's the reason. The other possibility is just from a higher ed administration perspective, they look at enrollment. And so that could be related to, the marketplace. If people don't see jobs there, then they're not going to school for those jobs. Enrollment is low when the programs get cut. But there's another question then, which is, why aren't philosophy programs getting cut, when they have three majors, right? So we don't touch the canon, and those are, we're pretty wedded to. But we pretty readily cut programs that maybe don't have as long a history in the in academia, and that don't have as strong of a disciplinary base.
Right, because youth work and child and youth care is quite an eclectic, right? I mean, some of the chapters in the book really outline all the different disciplines that it can draw upon, and where does one locate youth studies or child and youth care studies? Is it sociology? Right. Is it anthropology? Is it education? Education? Is it recreation? Where does it fall?
Exactly. Yeah.
As we wrap up, I want to say that there's a lot of really fascinating chapters in this book, and it really motivated me to think about where youth work is across the world, and it has allowed me to reach out to a variety of people for this podcast, as well as in my own teaching and my own youth work. So I want to thank you for contributing this book to the field, because I think these trends and questions are present and haven't been pulled together and asked. So I think you did an excellent job pulling this together. And as you said, you are going to be doing a special issue of a journal in the spring, which I very much look forward to.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you would like to cover before we wrap up today, Dana?
I can probably speak to many things, to nothing at all. I'll leave that for you to decide.
Okay. Well, I think we'll end it there. I want to say that it's been a pleasure speaking with you. It's been a pleasure getting to know you over the past couple months.
We've collaborated
on some stuff, and I look forward to continuing the questions, because I think that they're really important questions. They're crucial questions for us as a field right now, around the competencies, the credentials, the higher education, and there is not, I don't think, enough dialogue around them. And I'm concerned with some of some of the movement that I'm seeing in our field and wondering where the place is to put a pause and to reflect upon it.
Yeah, I like the phraseology, you know, pause, because, you know, sometimes we move rather quickly, again, because of, you know, good intentions and such, but I do think that a pause is not necessarily a bad thing. Mm-hmm. The other thing, just to add quickly, because you said to continue the dialogue, and so I wanted to invite the listeners to join me and us on my Facebook page, which is called Advancing Youth Work. It's the name of the book. So if you have a Facebook account, you could just search Advancing Youth Work. Or if you're a tweeter, it's Youth Work at ADV. Short for advance. They didn't give me enough characters for the whole thing. So there's lots of good dialogue with people around the world on these issues.
Yes, definitely. I will try to put some links up on the website for that as well. So,
great.
Dana Fusco, thank you very much for taking the time out of your marking at the end of term.
Thank you, Wolfgang.
Have this conversation. And we will talk again soon.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.